Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Here is an interview I've been wanting to share for a while. I was the guest on Missio Dei with host Jonathan Fessenden, and we were talking about Catholic movies. It's a collaboration I've been enjoying a lot. The movie was Mel Gibson's Apocalypto from 2006. It's about the Mayas in the Yucatan Peninsula on the eve of the Spanish conquest of Mexico. So talking about it now follows well from the Aztec Prophecy episode in the Virgen of Guadalupe that we just recorded with Julian and Monique Gonzalez last month. It was episode 74. It came out in December of 2023. And then also the most recent interview with Brant Hansen, episode 75, which came out at the beginning of the year 2024. It's about how to be a good and useful man in today's world. The connection is because we talk about the role of Mel Gibson. He's such a devout Catholic and such a human sinner, as I am, as you are. But he's in the public eye, which is lidless and unrelenting. So he's interesting already, but through him, we enter into a discussion of how the church should behave in the face of her scandals. We are such broken tools, all of us, and yet we still have to proclaim the gospel in this fallen world. So that's where I'm going, and that's what we talked about. And in any case, this movie is a masterpiece and just an interesting opportunity for historical discussion. So let's talk it over. As usual, the original YouTube interview is below with other useful links. But what follows here is a slightly abridged audio version. I enjoyed it so much, and I hope you do too.
Apocalypto. It's a movie that was directed by Mel Gibson. Many people probably know the movie, right? I'm thinking so.
If you don't know the movie, go watch it and come back, because there's a lot of surprises in it that I think we absolutely have to talk about that are fun to watch on your own first.
Yeah, pause the video, come on back.
Yeah. And right, now you can watch it on Amazon Prime if you have that for free. So go do that.
So let's jump into it. You want to give a little detail on the film? I know that you've, you know, you're like really a scientist here.
This is it. This is my field. I study 16th century Spanish Empire. This is the 16th century Spanish Empire. And it is this film is for me, it's an absolute joy. And it is a great spectacle. It's a proper Hollywood spectacle, like Ben-Hur, like Cleopatra, which I don't think I ever saw, but like any of those big classic Hollywood movies with where they build a Maya city. You know, there's no CGI in it. Mel Gibson recorded this entirely in Yucatec Maya, you know, kind of like Passion of the Christ was filmed in Aramaic with a little bit of Latin here and there, or some Greek maybe, I don't remember. But this is filmed entirely in Maya with subtitles. All the actors are speaking to each other in that language. The two principal figures, the hero and the villain, are both American actors, and they had to learn the language. And I think everybody else are Mexican extras who are native Maya speakers. I think I don't know how many hundreds of thousands or millions of people speak Maya. It seems to me like 1.5 million people speak Nahua, which is the Aztec language. when I was a high school kid, I did a 2-week exchange trip in Maya country, in the state of Campeche, and my host family, they spoke Maya, not mainly, but they knew it. You know, it was kind of like if you have a friend whose parents are from another country, they know a bunch of words and they're happy to share. And since we were all 16, they would teach me all the curse words and stuff like that. So the Maya culture is alive and well in the year, at least it was when I was there in the late 90s or mid 90s, long ago. And I'm sure it's even stronger now. So these people are with us. They are a thriving indigenous population. And when you talk to people who study Mexico, especially, there's a lot of, you know, sacrifice that continues on covertly. I interviewed a guy named David Tavares, who works on the Zapotec indigenous people in Oaxaca, and he finds animal sacrifices. And I asked him explicitly, is there still human sacrifices? And he said, well, we don't, you know, it's hard to say because it's not something people want to share. So that's the idea.
I'm glad you brought that up, because there was something I wanted to ask you. You had sent me a podcast that I was telling you that I was listening to. I actually very enjoyed it. The one out of the UK. Do you remember the name of the podcast?
It's called Best Pick, and it's spelled P-I-C-K, but it has two meanings. Like, you know, our best choice, but also like the best pick, as in the best motion picture. And so there are a bunch of film critics who have really done their homework, and they're quite critical of Mel Gibson, you know, and perhaps fairly, but I think they are also critical of his work.
I was glad to hear. I mean, I was glad to listen to that podcast because it even challenged me in particular ways, being a Catholic, because I kind of get the thread that they really weren't on board with a lot of, you know, particular religious ideology, and that's fine. But one thing I wanted to mention was, I believe the guy's name is John Dorney. He had mentioned that, well, Mel Gibson got it wrong. It was the Aztecs that were doing the human sacrifices, not the Mayans. You want to do some clarification on that? Because from my understanding, I've done research on this too, there certainly was Mayan sacrifices of human sacrifice going on. There's a lot of literature on this topic. So I'm not sure why, you know, maybe he just didn't do his homework on that, because I do think he's a very learned individual, or there was a bias of just against Mel Gibson.
Yeah, you know, that's a really good question. Yes, there's definitely Maya human sacrifice. They definitely have the poles where they gather human skulls in their temples. These are called tzompantli. They're present at Chichen Itza, which is the big Maya temple that I visited as a teenager in Campeche and Yucatan back in the 90s. So it definitely exists. I think because we know the Aztecs better, because that is on the Aztec capital of Tenochtitlan, that's where Mexico City stands today. So when you go to Mexico City, you're very likely to go visit that. And I think most Americans who visit Mexico will see Aztec ruins before they see Maya ruins. And what do we need to say about the Maya civilization? It reached its peak 500 years before the Spanish came. So what we're dealing with here is sort of a post-classical Maya civilization. They are the remnants of a great civilization. We're getting them 500 years later. So they reached their peak before that. It was an Aztec period. The big kids on the block were the Aztecs, or they're called the Mexica, which is where we get the word Mexico, or the Nahua people. They definitely had human sacrifice, but just because the Aztecs were the bigger kids on the block at the time, people think, oh, he just wanted to film it in the forest, but it's really a commentary on the Aztecs. We don't meet the Aztecs until 1519, when Cortez lands at Veracruz. We knew the Maya 10, 15 years ago when this movie is set. So Columbus sails the ocean blue in 1492. He first goes to the Caribbean. The Spanish set up in Hispaniola, which is the island where Haiti and Dominican Republic are today. And then they set up in Cuba. So Cuba is really the first big colony. And from Cuba, they start sailing in a number of directions. And so by 1502, 1504, there are Spaniards shipwrecked off the Maya coast. There are Spanish contacts with the Mayas in Yucatan. They just haven't met the Aztecs yet. So I think it's very appropriate to set it in the Maya world. And I've read, you know, some critiques like, oh, the murals are from the wrong era. Or one very interesting one is by a historian I admire, named Camilla Townsend, who says there definitely is human sacrifice, but it's a somber thing. Whereas here it's, you know, it's kind of like a rave or an orgy, or like, I sort of feel these are the Romans at the Colosseum, you know, going wild for blood, for bread and circuses. And for Mel Gibson, that works well because he's trying to comment on a decadent society. And he's using this, the Maya city, to show us, you know, you can be rich and sophisticated. You can be wise in the ways of science, as the Maya were, but you can also lose your moral compass. And so he takes this simpler society of people in the forest who've never been to the big city, and they're captured by slavers and taken into the city to be sold or sacrificed as slaves. And they have, you know, they have the natural horror that anybody who lives a simple life in the countryside suddenly comes to the big city, and it's shocking and horrific. So he's using that as a commentary for us. And he's reflecting all humans in the mirror of this time and place, right? This the narrative is in the detail, and he's setting the narrative at this time. So for his purposes, you know, maybe he doesn't care which mural is on the wall.
Yeah.
But other people say, like, hey, we see so few Mesoamerican indigenous people on the big screen. Why would you pick this? It would be as if, you know, all of Europe were the Roman Colosseum, where people are cheering as someone's getting devoured by a lion. And then we're like, see, this is what Rome is. Whereas Rome is a number of things. We're just seeing the darker side of it. So that's the critique,
yeah.
Which I think is worth listening to, but I don't agree with it. I think all the good guys are indigenous Maya people too. It's like that famous line from Solzhenitsyn, where the line of good and evil goes through the center of every human heart. Mm. We're all good. We're all evil.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
Perfect quote for this movie. You know, the opening quote, by the way, is really what stuck me in a lot of ways. I think this is, regardless of any historical inaccuracies, I don't think that was really, from what I've read too, Mel's real main agenda. It's pretty obvious to me he was very concerned with, you know, trying to preserve particular things, but I don't think his agenda was here to get, you know, everything historically like accurate with mirror, all this kind of things. He was here to tell a story. The opening quote is, you know, a great civilization is not conquered from without until it has destroyed itself from within, which was.
Yeah. That guy, his name is Will Durant. He and his wife Ariel wrote this like 15 volume history of everything back in the 1950s, which was very popular at that time. And he really does try to capture the whole story of human civilization across all the continents. So that's a universal truth. I'm glad you picked up on that, because that frames it. A very similar line, this is maybe a little silly, but appears in the 1976 George Lucas novel Star Wars that became his movie. He begins with, "So it was with the Republic at its height, like the greatest of trees able to withstand any external attack. The Republic rotted from within, though the danger was not visible from the outside." So that's us all. And if, you know, I live here in the East Bay in California, and when I take my kids to the opera in San Francisco, because standing room is $10, it's like the height of culture for $10 a person. Mm. But we go through the Civic Center of San Francisco, and there's a really interesting spiritual poverty. You know, it's such a rich city. You know, there's people laying on the sidewalks on drugs or half undressed, sort of passed out. And it's really hard. You know, I've sort of started avoiding downtown while we're waiting for the opera to start. But even so, like a person who's strung out and on the sidewalk, they'll see a small child coming and they'll kind of apologize and withdraw, you know, like, oh, I'm sorry. Here comes like a dad with some kids. Let me get out of his way. So they have shame. And we all have, every society has this. And the richer you are, the more in danger you are of alienating people who are all alone and sort of go crazy. If it's ancient Rome, if it's ancient Yucatan, or if it's San Francisco in 2023.
Yeah, I understand. Well, let me jump in to something else before getting really deep into the film. And one of the main thing, like I was mentioning with that podcast, which by the way, I like that podcast, is how we all can be a biased to a film a lot of times, depending on maybe the director, the actors. And it really appears with this film, especially at the height of what was going on with Mel Gibson, even though the film did very, very well in the theater, from what I read, he put $40 million into it, and $120 million was made at the box office. This is nothing to sneeze at. This is quite a successful movie in a lot of ways. As time has gone on, I think it's kind of fallen off the radar. And I'm sure that a lot of this has to do with Mel Gibson being the director. A lot of people, again, have a bias towards something. I'm not going to watch it because it's Mel. He's this or that. It's like we were talking a little bit beforehand about that movie, Sound of Freedom, and how that's even taken a hit, maybe because I think it's taken a hit personally just because the people that are attached to it. The story should be just like in this Apocalypto, just a universal story. We shouldn't be having political division or, you know, over this very important topic. Mel Gibson's topic is a little different, of course. It's the human spirit here. So what are your thoughts?
That's such a good question. I very much agree with you. I saw Sound of Freedom in July, and I thought it was super important. And I hope, like, they compare it to Uncle Tom's Cabin. And I think it's going to be an Uncle Tom's Cabin in the sense that it alerts us to a great injustice going on. And what can we as a society do? Like Uncle Tom's Cabin, it's a little preachy. and that's part of the idea. And I hope to have one of the Operation Underground folks on Almost Good Catholics. We've been emailing back and forth. Understandably, they're super busy. They've got a lot going on, bigger than me. So at some point when it's the right moment, I can find out how exactly are they rescuing children. I guess that the protagonist had some kind of MAGA commitments and YouTube gaffes and things like that, that they said like, oh, well, this is that kind of thing. But it's not. It's for everybody. Everybody agrees that child slavery should be ended, right? And likewise with Mel Gibson, like, he got drunk here and there, and he railed against Jews, and he railed against Black people, and he was not the best husband, and and I'm sure he's apologized up and down, but people cannot forgive that. And I think partly because he, as a, he's such an outspoken Catholic, and we as the Catholics were like, hey, we've got the right answer, and we don't often remember to be humble with that. There's a lovely example of a Franciscan by the name of Saint Francis Solano, and he says that sometimes the lives of Christians hinder the spread of the gospel of Jesus Christ. Like, if we've got the answer, and we're like, hey, you should join this organization because we have found it, with a capital I,
right?
And then we do something reprehensible. Well, you and I know that we're all sinners. You and I know that we mess up left and right. But somebody on the outside is saying like, well, why would I listen to Mel Gibson? He doesn't seem like such a moral guy. I, who don't believe anything, I don't, I'm better than that. So we should all be very cautious. One, not to be too preachy and pushy, but two, to try to, like, before we convert others, we got to convert ourselves. And
right.
And that's a process, and it takes a whole lifetime. And I think it's only our example that spreads the gospel more effectively than certainly standing on a pulpit and declaring it. So that's a cautionary tale for everybody.
We all need an aspect of charity. All of us need to give an aspect of charity to the human life, the human cause. It's not without its challenges. I mean, we've all been there.
You know, somebody like Mel Gibson was catapulted to fame quite early as a movie star in the 80s. You know, I think few people can handle that amount of strain, and I doubt I could.
Jump into the film a little bit too.
Yes. So let's take the movie by itself, right? Because Mel Gibson's a complicated man. Done. The movie is a work, is just beautiful. It's a cinematographical achievement of great proportion. The shooting, the scenes, the way the camera moves through the leaves, the way the forest is arranged. And just the world. He created a world with 700 extras who had to put on makeup every day, with tattoos and hair and such detail. You know, nothing is CGI. Everything is real. He built that city outside of Veracruz. He shot it in the forests of Yucatan, in southern Yucatan, very close to where I was as a kid. And it's a spectacular movie, and it moves at a clip. And it's really, it's a chase, right? The whole thing is a chase as our hero is escaping from the Maya city where he was to be sacrificed, racing back to his village where he hid his wife in a limestone sinkhole, like a limestone cistern for collecting water. Well, it starts raining, the water is getting collected, and she's about to give birth to their child, and she's about to drown. And like these, you know, it is a perfect adventure. I think he described it as he wanted to make a car chase, but he wanted to make it, you know, 500 years ago. And it's a huge achievement. As the people who know so well about film said, Scorsese loved it, Tarantino loved it, Spike Lee loved it. You know, people who know movies and who make movies that we love, love this movie. And it's a whole world that he has successfully created and brought us into. So that's a great thing he did. And I think it'll grow in time too. You know, people will like it more and more.
Yeah, I could see this being like on the Criterion Channel or something down the road, you know, and really looking at this as a classic for sure. And I particularly love, it's an American director that used, as you said, the Mayan language within it. A lot of these films that maybe portray other cultures and then they use English speaking, it's always never quite there with me when this happens. You know, I watch some of these great movies that might be taking place in Russia, which I watched recently, a particular movie, and they were speaking in English. It's just, okay, I know that the audience, it could still kind of convey the same message, but I really want to be transported.
Yeah, and that's exactly the right word. You as the viewer are transported. It begins small. You're following a band of hunters in the woods. The opening sequence is a little hunt. It reminds us a bit of Last of the Mohicans, where, you know, it begins, you're hunting an animal, in this case, a tapir, I think. And it ends with a hunt where you are, you know, the predator is turned into the prey. And then we get to know them in their village. It takes its time in the first 20 minutes to really flesh them out as human beings. You know, we get to meet their families, their children. We get to see the, you know, his one friend, Blunted, who's having trouble he's having trouble conceiving, and his mother-in-law is a really, it's just like a harpy making his life miserable, and his friends never relent. And they're just always teasing him about that and playing practical jokes.
And like, we're very childlike in that.
Puerile, right? And part of it is that he's the big guy, you know, he's kind of like, he's the big strong one. So they mock him for this way. He's not as big and strong. He's like the Obelix to the Asterix of our protagonist. And our hero is like this great guy, and his father's this great hunter and, you know, village leader. And we get to know these families, and we care about them, and we like them. And they do that very quickly. Then they get captured as slaves by this marauding band of Mayas from the city. And we go with them into this city. They've never seen a city, and neither we. So as they are going from the outskirts to the center and passing through sort of the devastated cornfields and then like the limestone quarry pits and then into this amazing marketplace, a marketplace like you've never seen, with every detail done like that. They spend like 10 minutes going through there, and we see the entire society, and we see it with new eyes because we've never seen it, and neither have the protagonists. So they kind of carry us with them into this new world. And in the middle of the thing, there's the human sacrifice scene, and then the second half of the film is just the escape, which, you know, so it's so well structured. And then, of course, I'm going to say here, stop me if you don't want me to say it, like at the very last moment when it all is lost, our hero's on the beach, and in the distance, you know, he sees the Spanish ships arrive. And we know what that is, but neither the guy running for his life nor the people trying to kill him know what that is. And it's as if aliens came from outer space. And because we just spent 2 hours with the Maya in their world, in their language, with their costumes, when we see these crazy aliens with hair on their face, wearing metal on their body, right, with garment, like clothed head to toe, with, you know, on these ships that carry men. We're like, wow, that is from another world. And the sense of wonder that we can have at something so familiar as a Spanish galleon 500 years ago is such an, like, you've completely forgotten that there were Europeans because you've been a Maya for 2 hours and you were so invested in the fortunes of these people. It's such a brilliant reversal. It knocks my socks off every time, even though I know it's coming. I think it's a cinematic moment of genius.
To back up to the part when they came in the city real quick.
Mm-hmm.
It's definitely a lot of people's favorite part of the movie. You really get into this new world. You really see the marauders that take the tribe into the city. And I'm thinking, like, wow, here you go. This more advanced, quote unquote, advanced culture that has more technology and advancements.
Yeah, it is. You're right. But it is. They're more advanced materially.
Yes,
they've lost their way.
Thank you. And this is what I think, you know, in my view, or at least I'm going to take a Catholic view or spiritual view here, that an advancement of society a lot of times loses a spiritual depth as well, which in our culture today, I really believe the same thing is very much going on. We've lost our way in so many ways. The biggest thing, of course, being that God, who was once at the top and should always be at the top, is in our society not the main thing. For me, this is, of course, I'll lose secular people here on this particular topic, and that's fine. I'm not trying to persuade anybody in any particular kind of way, but I'm saying that, you know, in my own particular life, living not always like this, of course, this really returned me to my natural order. Through that, I've returned to natural things of being a man. And I think, you know, from my view, this is really what a lot of what Mel Gibson's saying. And that's why I think that particular jaguar paw walks away when the Spanish come up. I think he knows to look at, I've had enough of this. I need to preserve what I know is right. Now, he may not ultimately be able to walk away because it's going to infiltrate society, which is just what's happening in my own society. I understand I don't put up walls to the secular world here. I'm very much in it. But I'm trying to, of course, balance my natural order of a man and how to live a proper life without being, you know.
Well, who knows? He may have escaped, right? He may have gone far enough into the forest. He may have walked from Yucatan to, you know, what is it?
I wish I could do that. I wish I could go away from a lot of this stuff. I mean, I guess I could, but
you could build yourself a cabin in Alaska. You can do that. You probably build yourself a cabin in Utah.
I still have, you know, comforts, certain comforts that you know, I like to have. And in our American society, money is still quite a necessity.
Fair enough. Yeah. No, that's right. So he escapes from, you know, he is part of the forest ecosystem. And once he runs out of that city and he gets back, he jumps off of a waterfall, he leaves the river, and now he's in his familiar hunting grounds. And he yells across the waterfall, I am Jaguar Paw. This is my forest. My father hunted this forest before me. My son will hunt it after I'm gone, and his son after him. And that declaration, my name is Inigo Montoya. You killed my father. Prepare to die. Or Neo in the Matrix, you know, my name is Neo. That sort of thing. Like, I declare that this is who I am. This is where I belong. And this is where I am a master of my surroundings. And he uses that forest with snakes and poisonous frogs and a mud pit and bees and an actual jaguar. He's able to turn that forest against his pursuers. So he's home and he has tremendous wisdom, knowledge, like a sort of a natural science of that place. So I think if he and his wife and their children walk far enough away. They're not going to, they can live for generations and generations, and they can be the people who speak Maya today.
Yeah, you're right. You're right.
It could happen.
No.
And he makes that, but you're right. And he rejects it. He's like, look, I've seen enough of this fancy world. It's true that they have, you know, jade and high buildings, but they've definitely lost their way. I talked to a Jewish philosopher named Jacob Howland, who's at the University of Austin. And he says, you know, we should think about the things we build when we start to worship them as idolatry. That, you know, worshiping the things you build is a bit like building the Tower of Babel. Those Maya pyramids where you're building them for your own glory, that's the Tower of Babel. When we start to worship, I don't know, robots and AI and our own achievements, and we forget about God because we're so glued to our phones, it's all idolatry. And idolatry leads to ruin, as it did with the golden calf at the base of Mount Sinai. So I think he understands that, you know, there is a natural religion. God speaks to us all, even those who don't know the biographical Jesus of the first century. Creation itself is the gospel. God is present to everybody everywhere. I think he demonstrates that. And also, like, they show compassion to the other people who've been uprooted and driven out of their homelands. Like, they're kind to strangers. They're the only ones who are kind to strangers. Jaguar Paws Band.
Yes, Jaguar. I like the fact, too, that this is a intercultural war. These people are ethnically the same, correct?
Yeah, correct.
And I think that's something, as you said with the Solzhenitsyn quote, the devil exists in everything. You know, we get so busy in our culture today, modern culture, pointing the finger at this group and that group. The white man's guilty of this, is guilty of that. And a lot of times, I think we're really getting off the main point here, because as we know, there's black on black violence.
Mm-hmm.
We see in this movie, which is very true, just inner tribes you got evil over here. Okay, evil comes in and it doesn't care if you are of the same kin. The devil does not care if you look the same. All cultures have slavery within. I mean, who was doing the slavery in here? The same group.
And I think we often get into the trap of saying, you know, somebody will say, I feel really bad about my white privilege, so I'm going to say, look at what the white people did to black people. Look at what the Spaniards did to the people in the Yucatan. And then we are tempted to say, yeah, but, you know, isn't it better to be forced into a mission that you don't want to go to work in fields that you don't want to work on, rather than to be underneath a stone knife on top of a pyramid? So, but one doesn't have anything to do with the other. It would have been better had the Christians come with persuasion and love, rather than allow those conquistadors to force Indians onto their encomiendas to dig for gold or work for them in an early modern slavery model. So, okay, so they didn't do human sacrifice. But once upon a time, we did human sacrifice. That's evident in the story of Abraham and Isaac. When God tells Abraham, go sacrifice Isaac, he doesn't say, what are you talking about? I never heard of such a crazy thing. He says, okay. Right, because we had human sacrifice 4,000 years ago.
Right.
That same historian I referred to earlier, Camilla Townsend, she makes the point that you got to compare Maya not to 16th century Spaniards, but to second millennium BC Near Eastern people. Because remember how long it took humans to cross that land bridge and settle in America. It took a long time. The first Californians only got here 20,000 years ago. Right, the first people in the tip of South America only got there 12,000 years ago. So they just had a much less time to settle, to farm, to build cities, to do all that stuff we did in the Near East thousands of years earlier. They're just getting around to it now. So they're not primitive because somehow they're dumb or somehow their race is inferior. They're primitive because they just got here. And in addition, they didn't have all the stuff that the people had in the Near East from whom we are descended as European conquerors. Right, they didn't have so many domesticated animals in the Americas or so many grains that could give you a stable diet. They only had corn and beans. And corn and beans is not the same thing as wheat and barley and rye and oats and all the things that you could build a civilization on. If you ever read that Jared Diamond book, Guns, Germs, and Steel, he really makes that argument just by looking at how many animals are domesticated in places like India and China and Europe and Persia and Babylon and Egypt, the places that built our Western civilization, versus how many animals can be domesticated in the New World. They just didn't have the resources. They didn't have the time. And so for the Spaniards, it's more like time travel. You're sailing the ocean, but you've landed in, you know, ancient Babylon or something like that. And so, wow, they built the Tower of Babylon and they're killing people. And we did that too. We did that too. So a little humility, I think, you know, we shouldn't be too amazed at our own achievements. We just had a giant head start. And, you know, there's a trick, there's a trap for both people to say our race is superior, race is inferior. And the reverse trap is available. Our race is evil, and this race is somehow, you know, the pure, noble, primitive people close to the earth. You know, that's true for everybody, everywhere, all the time. All of it is true for everybody, because humans are humans, are humans are humans. But that moment of human sacrifice was horrific to the Spaniards when they found it, and so they recoiled in horror and fear, and they wanted to destroy it. Even though many Spanish missionaries were really good. My favorite is Bartolome de las Casas, who said, like, you can't enslave these people if you want them to become Christians. And Queen Isabella, who died kind of young, also said, like, you can't enslave my vassals in America. You're supposed to be making them Christians. But there was such a distance from her court in Valladolid to whatever some encomendero wanted to do in Mexico. Like, the orders came from far away and you could do whatever. And if you're trying to get rich and exploit the people, there was kind of impunity. And, you know, the church can't push you around if you have guns and steel. if you're, you know, Cortez is a villain and Las Casas is a hero. And likewise, the fellow I quoted, St. Francis of Solano, is a hero. And Motolinía is a hero. There's a lot of really heroic Catholic Christians in Mexico. I mean, it's a Christian country today, right? And so is the Philippines. And so are other places where this empire appeared, despite the predatory inclinations of some of its worst actors. There were also heroic and loving and humble people who spread the gospel effectively, not only with words, but with example, and protected the Indians against their would-be exploiters. And there was plenty of American Indian allies who said, like, I've had enough of the Aztecs. Tlaxcala Indians, for instance, we've had enough of the Aztecs capturing us. We don't know who you are, but we know we don't like them. So let's help you go fight and capture Tenochtitlan. And so very small number of Spaniards with large number of Indian allies were able to overthrow these old civilizations quickly. And again, in Peru, very quickly. And lest it be forgotten, there's a very small amount of Spaniards. So everybody who was running the Spanish Empire, most of them were natives too. They were just like, this is a better order. This is, it's also, there's inequality, but we're used to inequality. We just don't want any more human sacrifice.
You know, rewinding back to the beginning quote of the film, I wanted to touch on again, which was, a great civilization is not conquered from without, until it destroys itself from within. As someone who really does like Mel Gibson, like myself, I'm a big follower of Mel Gibson. Mm-hmm. I like a lot of what he says. I've been following him for many years, and I know his Catholicism is rather traditional in a lot of ways, and I personally don't have any problem with that. This is my viewpoint. I think he's also sending a message here to about the Catholic Church. It's my view, because and maybe it's good for people to realize too, as we're talking about that there could be problems in the Catholic Church. The Catholic Church can only be overtaken from within, not from without, which is what the quote is kind of say. We are also under attack here. We are very much under attack in many ways from forces that, and most honestly, we can't even see with the eyes.
Mm.
And I think people who want to look at all the bad things that may have happened within the church and certain things forget that we are in a battle. We are very much the tribe that is trying to hold on to particular things. And there is evil that wants to attack us. And sometimes this evil, I'll just say, it gets into the church as well. We go back for thousands of years, you know?
That's totally right. I admire Mel Gibson in his most recent role in Father Stu, because he was Father Stu's dad, and that guy had a troubled relationship with his father. You know, like he plays himself as a flawed person trying to climb toward the light, trying to repent, trying to embrace the gospel and repent from his sinful ways. And Father Stu, like his dad, they were both, you know, feisty. Sometimes they were drunken asses. They did all the things that we all do, and yet they found mercy and salvation in the church. And I think that's what Mel Gibson's secular critics will never accept that from him. Look, you know, yes, you failed. You are a sinner just like me, but I'm sitting here anonymously on Twitter throwing slings at you, and you're out there taking them all. I don't think it bothers him, because it's kind of a little social media martyrdom, and I'm sure he's used to that. I'm sure every famous person becomes used to that. I think where the church needs to change is we keep having the scandals are the scandals, but then there's these cover-ups and these moving of priests and these bishops who didn't do enough at the time and won't say so. And that's where we're fighting, because look at we're sinners too, but we haven't figured out how to. It's almost like we're afraid that if we say, look at these terrible things that have been done in the name of the church. I mean, very contrary to everything the church stands for, but done in the name and with the trappings of the church. And how you get these older clerics who are really just trying to defend the reputation rather than, I mean, Pope Francis is brilliant at always meeting with victims, like he did in Portugal most recently, like he does everywhere he goes. He's like, let's first talk about the people that, you know, villains, you know, wolves in sheep clothing in the trappings of the church have wounded you. You're the first person I need to talk to, because those are my sins before I start preaching about anything else. So, I think we've come a long way just in one generation.
I think so too. Yeah. You know, I was actually reading something Bishop Barron said recently. Oh, he wrote something or said something on Twitter or talked about the problem in the church. He's going a little harder lately on things that how the outside culture is infiltrating our church. So he had said that 79% of Catholics are leaving the faith before the age of 23. And that college can often be a watershed moment for young people making the choice. He's trying to get his book out to people. And I'm glad that he's bringing some of this up, because it really backs up the film and what my main thing from the film that I take away is preserving. There's nothing wrong with preserving your culture, right? If that's only if you're doing other things that are, you know, like we say, might be racist to it, to particular things or do that, but there's nothing wrong with building up inside your group and protecting your beliefs, your heritage, your traditions, when they are being constantly attacked.
Yeah, it's the logic of the confessional. We have to say these things out loud so that we ourselves become separated from them, so that we who we are is different from the sins that we have committed, because that's the way to separate yourself from the sin and then repent, like literally metanoia, literally turning the other way. And that's where I think is our next step. When we had the synod on synodality in my parish a couple years ago now, this was I don't know how long ago, a year and a half, something. It was on Zoom, so I know it's a little while ago instead of in person. You know, the parishioners here are like, well, we're really upset about the clerical scandals. Scandals is what we're upset about. And our pastor, whom I admire a great deal, said, you should know that the scandals with, you know, like sexual abuse within the church is lower than sexual abuse in general, right? There's sinners everywhere. There's humans everywhere. The church is built of humans. And in, you know, Catholic predators dressed as priests are fewer than predators not dressed as priests. They're like people who are not priests and are abusive are more in proportion. And that's a very important point. But I also think that it's different for priests, just like it's different for you and I who are teachers. Like we have a higher standard, or if you're a scoutmaster, or if you're a policeman, or if you're a like any kind of politician, if a politician does something, it's everybody's business. That, like, just because other people are just as guilty, we who are professing a different path, a moral path, a path that's supposed to renounce the self and embrace God, we have a higher bar. I don't like saying, like, yeah, but other people are sinners too. It's like, you're right, we did do that wrong, let's do it better, and let's not pretend it wasn't a terrible thing. I'm only in charge of my own sins, I'm not in charge of your sins.
People need to be, as I said earlier, they need to be charitable to the human journey here.
Yeah.
We're all really trying to do our best. We're all trying to do our best. And we love our faith. We have particular things that have made our tribe and our group, I believe, very, very special. And, you know, we're here to outreach, to help the poor, to do all these kind of things. It's part of our mission. Of course,
absolutely.
We're going to have some bad apples.
Absolutely. And we forget that. You know why? Because wherever you are in your advance, that becomes the new normal. So we assume there should be schools. We assume there should be hospitals. We assume there should be help for the poor. Well, these are all inventions of the Catholic Church in the West. There were no schools 1,000 years ago till the Catholics made them. There were no hospitals. There was no, you know, there was no alms for the poor. This is all the work of armies and armies of friars and clerics and ordinary devout lay people who have built this society that we live in. This society that we live in is such a Christian society through and through, where we believe in the dignity and equality of all people, that we forget how we got here. And so that's normal, right? It's always harder to, everybody registers it more if you lose $5 than if you find $5, you know, and we just, wherever we are, that's, of course we're going to have care for the poor. Everybody has care for the poor. Well, that's not true. That's an invention of Christians in the West. And so that's also an important point, which I think is forgotten. So the question is, where to next?
Where to next?
In spreading the gospel, yeah.
Well, you know, Bishop Barron said the same thing the other day. Dumbed down Catholicism has not helped evangelization. These are strong words. This is mm-hmm. something that I have never heard him speak like this, because I've always felt he's been very much in the middle in a lot of ways, and maybe doesn't want to. But I think it's gotten to a point, and he's really, you know, blaming a lot of the evangelization within the pastors and the watering down. And I would say, from what I've read and what I listened to him on, the bending over to the secular society, bringing it into the church and getting it watered down. Now we're losing people, but he's saying that younger people want authentic Catholicism. That doesn't mean that they need to be Latin Mass, you know, extreme this. I'm not saying Latin Mass are extreme, because I love the Latin Mass. I don't think that's extreme at all. But I think a lot of people, they want substance to be a part of it. I know when I return to the Catholic faith, when I return, I'm sure you might feel the same way. It's like, yeah, I really want the truth. I don't need the rock and roll music to come into the Mass this in order to get my spirit up, right? That's not why I'm here. I mean, I don't even need, honestly, to have the best priest delivering a homily that's going to knock me off my feet, because I know the Eucharist, of course, the body of Christ is there, and I want really an authentic delivery of the faith to teach me how to live good moral values in a society that, as Bishop Rivers say, is really losing its moral compass.
Absolutely right. And it's better for it to be hard to do, and you are insufficient when you start, but slowly, slowly, through prayer and effort and graces from God, you are able to reach the better plateau, than to be told, oh, everything you're doing is fine. Don't worry about it. I'm okay. You're okay.
you raise kids. I mean, you have kids. I'm a school teacher. Oh, we're both school teachers.
Yeah.
And I started this year 6th, 7th, and 8th, by the way. So I got a really big difference. Mm-hmm. And they are yearning for discipline.
In fact,
do your kids, I mean, they want to see how far they can take things, right? I'm talking about kids and everything. And this is the same way in the faith and everything. And I test God. I'm always trying to see how far I can go, what I can get away with.
Yeah. No. And just let it be something you can aspire to and reach for. And when you fail, know that that's okay. We love you and try again. Let me help you. Let me pick you back up, dust you off, try again. And I have found that every time I've grown, it has been through prayer and trying again and praying and trying again. And I'm a better person than I was 5 years ago, than I was 10 years ago, than I was 20 years ago. But if somebody said like, oh, it's fine, you know, go ahead, try to have sex with lots of people, look at pornography, drink, take drugs, cheat, steal, lie. It's fine. We're all just, it's all good. God loves you. You do you. You do you. I'm okay. You're okay.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, you do you. There's no, why would I, everything is subjective.
Relativism.
That's really unsatisfying. That's really unsatisfying. Yeah. And I'd rather be a failure at something that's really exciting and watch myself become stronger at it than be told like, nah, you're already there. Because then you're going to look around and say like, well, this is not much of anything. Like, why? Surely God intended, you know, for us to do more exciting things. There's a really nice quotation from Hamlet. I really feel this about the Maya cities. You know, there's like the rich people lounging around, the Maya king and the Maya queen. The king looks really sedated. He's just like he's just like gazing off into the distance. The high priest is really running the show. There's like that little fat kid sitting there. You know, and there's all these really decadent people painted and dressed in jade and showing contempt for the poor and just sort of like lounging around, you know, like every decadent stereotype of ancient Rome and stuff like that. And then we have these hunters who still have a lot of virtue, like true virtue. And it reminds me of Hamlet's moment when he's looking over at the armies of Fortinbras and he's wondering, like, what am I even doing? And he says, what is a man if his chief good and market of his time be but to sleep and feed, a beast no more. Sure, he that made us with such large discourse, looking before and after, gave us not that capability and godlike reason to fust in us unused. And that's what I think. Like the people Bishop Barron's talking about, they're like, is this it? Just TikTok and video games and drugs and money and I'm ordering food and I'm watching TV. That's nothing. That's not a life. That's
being
very dissatisfying.
You know, like comfort. It's good. Comfort. It's good to a degree, and it also scares me.
Yeah. And so we need one day out of seven, like today. Happy Sabbath.
Yes. Well, you know, we have a day. We should be resting nicely on Sundays. It should be a day that we don't overdo it. It should be a day to be respected of the Lord, the Christian Sabbath. It should be something that, you know, we acknowledge and put God at the center of.
No, I agree. 2 days out of seven is better.
Yeah,
with an occasional Monday off for Labor Day was just even better. That's the perfect amount.
Yeah.
But so after that, we lose our minds. We get really, like, everything loses its flavor. Everything loses its sweetness. Everything loses its salt. So if salt loses its saltiness, what good is it just to be trampled?
I like that.
He's standing. He's like watching the armies of Norway crossing Denmark, and they're off to go fight in Poland. And he's like, "What am I even doing? Look at those guys, you know." And maybe I'm not saying go invade Poland. That's the opposite of what I'm saying. I'm just saying, like, look at people doing an adventure.
I think
for
what
a
you
purpose.
Were doing was making a segue back to Apocalypto because Mel Gibson was in Hamlet.
Yes, he was. Oh, yes, he was.
So let's finish this up here. And
absolutely.
And obviously, we both recommend the movie. We think it's essential walk. And we both, I mean, at least I'll just speak for me and let you speak. But I think this is a classic one. It's just it's a perfect film.
Yeah, I agree.
Now maybe some people won't like, there's a lot of violence. That's something to keep in mind. But I, you know, I'm an artist.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like violence for the sake of violence. But he uses what's necessary to convey a point. You know, and plus, again, like I say, I've been a musician. I have an artsy side to me. You know, I was in the film composition world for many years. So, by the way, which I love the film music. Okay, for people to watch it and maybe turned off a little bit by the violence, you have to know there's a necessity to this, I think. And you also just have to accept that this is his particular style. Just like in music, there's particular people that play things in a certain way, or they write in a certain manner to convey a point. But yes, I think this is going to be a classic. It's already how many years old anyways? It's still
2006, so 15, 13?
Yeah, yeah. It still holds up very, very well.
17?
Yeah, yeah. So if you haven't seen it, I think it's definitely a treat. Indeed.
Yeah, it's a very important film. I like your description of perfect. It is perfect. It's complete. There's nothing missing. And it's a whole world in itself. It expands from the village to this city and then contracts back to this extremely dynamic chase through the forest. Plenty of violence, but that is also the way of the jungle. And I don't think it's gratuitous. And where, you know, part of the horror that the slave raiders do to the village is sexual violence. And that is done sort of off camera. So, you know, it's going on, but you didn't like, it's not in the sense that you're, it's not like a slasher movie where you're supposed to revel in the suffering of humans and the splatter of red paint. There's plenty of red paint, I'm sure, but it's, this human sacrifice, I think, is done very well, because human sacrifice is something we're very far away from at this point, but we shouldn't ignore it because it exists in many cultures, including the cultures of the ancient Near East from which we are descended, at least through our religious tradition. So the Maya are awful, and they're also heroic. The Maya did sacrifice plenty of people. Plenty of Spaniards saw it with their eyes. Plenty of Christian friars who were descended from Mayas, who had one, like a Spanish father and an indigenous mother. They write about this too. The criticism makes sense in the fact that we don't know that much about that world the way we might know about ancient Rome, because we know about ancient Rome from... I'm sure from lots of, you know, plays and that we read in high school and college and BBC movies like I, Claudius and things like Spartacus. But it would be as if all we knew about ancient Rome was Gladiator, which I know probably has way more historical problems than this movie, but nobody talks about that one. So, that's where it is, but let's not sugarcoat it. Let's not say like, oh, everything was perfect until the evil Spanish came up, because that's not true. The Spanish are good and evil. The Maya are good and evil.
Right,
are good and evil. You, dear listener, are good and evil. And let us repent and embrace the gospel and be better and better and better and better every day.
Oh, thanks, Chris. No, I really appreciate this. This is a really good interview. And let me ask you, what do you got coming up next? What's coming on the Almost Good Catholics?
I've recorded a bunch of them toward the end of the summer before the academic year picked up. So I have some really nice ones that I'm editing. One with a luminous nun named Sister Mary Joseph, who writes about being a Benedictine nun in Missouri. I think that'll come out on September 14th. I've recorded a really interesting talk about the Book of Maccabees with a professor here at UC Berkeley, and book is fantastic too. I hope Mel Gibson was supposed to make one, and he quarreled with some other collaborators. So somebody needs to make a really great movie about the Book of Maccabees, because that is a nonstop action movie. Those whole two books. I was surprised to find Alexander the Great in the Bible, but he's there, and the true origin of Hanukkah, it's there. So that would be a cool movie if Mel Gibson wanted to make it.
I'm just waiting. Mel Gibson is going to actually finish the second.
Oh, yeah. The Harrowing of Hell, right?
The
Resurrection. Yeah.
And the Resurrection.
Right. Yeah. Well, when that comes out, I'm sure you and I will talk about it.
Oh, yeah. Well, again, it was a great conversation. I really enjoyed it. It's always great to see you. And you know,
it's an honor and a pleasure for me always to be on your program.
Let's end in a prayer here today. Yeah. In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit, amen. St. Michael the Archangel, defend us in battle. Be our defense against the wickedness and snares of the devil. May God rebuke him, we humbly pray. And do thou, Prince of the Heavenly Host, by the power of God, cast in hell Satan, all the evil spirits that prowl on the world, seeking ruin of souls. Amen. And may God bless you and everybody out there watching. May you please find peace within Christ and love your neighbors.
Nails, spear shall pierce him through the cross. Be born for me, for you, and hail, hail the Word made flesh, the Babe, the Son of Mary.
Chris Odinets and Jonathan Fessenden recorded this Missio Dei interview on Saturday, September 2nd, 2023. That was the Feast of the September Martyrs, 191 Catholics who were massacred at the Carmes prison during the French Revolution in 1792. I'm sharing it as episode 76 of Almost Good Catholics on Thursday, January 18th, 2024, which is the feast day of St. Ulfrid of Sweden, a missionary who was martyred on this day in 1028 by Norse pagans when he chopped down a statue of Thor. Our music is from Josh and Margot of the Great Space Coaster Band. Check them out at www.gscoasterband.com. Our logo, the image of the dog, comes from a stained glass window at the Monastery of Santo Domingo de Silos in Spain and is used with the permission of the Dominican Friars of England, Scotland, and Wales from their website, www.english.op.org. I'm Chris Odinets. I thank you for listening. Email me at almostgoodcatholics@gmail.com. I would enjoy it. I promise to answer. And I'll talk to you next time on Almost Good Catholics.
This is Christ the King, whom shepherds guard and angels sing.